Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, audience. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. And here with me today is my co-host, Elizabeth Santos, who will introduce herself in a few minutes. Feel free to call in, ask questions, or just provide feedback if you'd like. The call-in number is 657-383-1630. We are going to be honored to have on with us today our guest, Gary Cohen, who is a criminal defense lawyer from Texas. And I'm going to ask Gary to tell you a little bit more about himself as well as soon as we get our co-host settled in with you. So, Elizabeth, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself? And then we will have Gary introduce himself as well.
Sure. So my name is Elizabeth. I'm currently an undergraduate student, double majoring in psychology and criminal justice. I'll be graduating this May, so very exciting. The time is definitely coming up soon. And I participate in a lot of advocacy activities, including presiding over a campus organization called the Women's Affairs Council.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And Gary, we are honored to have, first of all, I'd like to thank my co-host because this is Elizabeth's first time co-hosting with me, and I feel honored to have her doing it. She's been an excellent advocate for the incarcerated. She's been an advocate in a lot of different areas, and I just appreciate her so much. Now, Gary Cohen, again, is a criminal defense attorney from Texas, and he's going to be introducing himself now, and I want to welcome him as well. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with us.
Leona, the pleasure is mine, and Elizabeth, I look forward to a great discussion with y'all this evening. My name is Gary Cohen. I am a criminal defense lawyer in Texas. For the last 35 years, my practice has been limited to representing incarcerated individuals in the state of Texas in matters related to parole and parole revocation. So this is all I do. I have testified frequently at the legislature in various matters regarding corrections bills. I'm a frequent lecturer in criminal defense lawyers seminars in the area of parole, and it's a field that is greatly neglected, but I find incredibly enjoyable and rewarding.
Thank you so much. And Gary, how long have you been an attorney now?
I've been an attorney for 50 years now.
Wow. And some of the cases that you've come across in your years?
Well, I mean, I've represented, I started out as a trial lawyer, doing traditional criminal defense work, and then got off into the corrections field. In my role as a parole lawyer, I've represented folks ranging from, you know, minor felony cases such as low-level drug possessions and nonviolent crimes such as burglaries and forgeries and thefts, all the way up to offenders who are serving life sentences for murder cases. I've dealt with a number of cases involving sexual assaults. So it's the whole panoply of criminal behavior. Currently, you know, my practice deals with the more serious offenders with long sentences and or complex criminal backgrounds.
You know, I wanted to ask you, and I will in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you now, Franz Del, a former 27-year warden from Amsterdam, and Franz has been, he's been involved in a lot of things. I mean, he's involved with the United Nations. He's involved with the Ministry of Psychiatry. This is all global. You know, the International Red Cross, he's involved with things that are going on in Texas right now, I believe, with you. How did you and Franz come to meet? And Franz is supposed to also be on with us today, so I don't know if he's going to be coming in late or not. But if you can just speak a little bit on that as well.
Certainly. There is a radio broadcast done in the southern part of Texas that is specifically oriented to prison populations. It's called The Prison Show. And it's been in existence for probably better than 20 years. And what it is, it's a broadcast where prisoners listen in, their loved ones can call in and share thoughts over the airwaves. And they have guest lecturers, guests just like you're having myself tonight. And I was on The Prison Show about 4 weeks ago, and France was on the show also. He followed me, and I found his remarks, and I found him to be just an incredible human being that I wanted to learn more about and to talk to. So I got a hold of the host of The Prison Show and asked him to put me in contact with Franz. And Franz and I ended up having a Zoom conversation for about an hour or an hour and a half after the show, several days after the show. And I just I found him to be fascinating. He is certainly a progressive in the area of criminal justice and penal reform. His background is phenomenal, and I just found him to be a kindred soul, and probably not long after our Zoom meeting, I was contacted by him and asked him if I wanted to join with him and yourself this evening on your show and continue our conversation.
You know, everyone loves Franz, and I'll tell you why. Franz told me, well, he's a family man anyway, but he told me that, you know, he made it a point when he was a warden to meet with prisoners periodically to get to know them and also to make them feel human. He said if you treat someone human then they and respectful, they're going to, you know, reciprocate. So ever since then, Franz has actually introduced me to many, and I brought many on the show from the Netherlands, you know, from Amsterdam, from Belgium and elsewhere. And these people were at one time prisoners. And they came out, they've written books, they've started organizations, you know, they're doing so well. And a lot of times people in society, they stereotype, and everybody that's in prison is supposed to be bad. Everyone's supposed to be hardcore criminal when we have so many different areas of incarceration. And also in the United States, as you probably know, Gary, we have an epidemic of mental illnesses and addictions in this country. Not only in the prisons, but outside in the communities. And this is something that is not being addressed. And I want to know your thoughts on this, because these people that are incarcerated, many of them have been traumatized as children or adolescents. Many of them have come from domestic violent homes. Many of them have come from drug-infested environments. And there's a lot of wrongfully convicted, and I'm sure you've defended people that were wrongfully convicted as well. But what are your thoughts on some of these things?
That's what I was going to ask also. I'm very curious because with sentencing guidelines having evolved over time, we've also seen like a rise in, you know, incarceration due to drug and substance abuse in general. So I'm also curious to know if you've seen like a higher frequency of cases that involve severe mental illness, especially since you see severe cases. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Texas is a very interesting jurisdiction. It's a very conservative state. It still has a bit of a old Western frontier mentality. You know, everyone who commits an infraction against the law should be punished harshly. We have some of the longest sentences of any state in the union, and we have probably the highest prison population of any other state in the United States. Texas is a state with about 30 million people, and our population of people who are incarcerated in the state prisons runs about 140,000 people. That does not include the number of pretrial detainees that are locked up in county jail, nor does it include the number of people who are on community supervision, such as probation or parole. The Texas prison system is notoriously harsh.
Mm-hmm.
The per diem amount of money that is spent on feeding an inmate is about $3 to $4 a day. Medical health services are dismal. Mental health services are almost non-existent, except for the extreme cases where you have people who are schizophrenic, catatonic, and they are locked up in designated state-run psychiatric facilities, in which the form of treatment there is basically medication rather than therapy. I have done this long enough to know that there are a lot of good people locked up in prison. There are a lot of people who, because of a confluence of circumstances in their lives, engaged in conduct that is not indicative of who they are. Prison, of course, is supposed to be an institution that, number one, punishes bad behavior, number two, protects the community, but number three, it's also supposed to be a place where someone can and is not only can, but is forced to look at themselves, to try to gain insight into decisions they made and consequences that flowed from those positions. And oftentimes when I do, you know, a workup on an individual, and in my mind, it's really important, if you want to understand criminal conduct, you can't look at it in isolation. You have to place it within the context of a person's life, because most people don't just wake up one morning and decide to engage in antisocial behavior. There's an evolution in the life history of a human being that leads them on a path. And I think that is the most important thing to look at when you're trying to make decisions about, has someone been punished enough? Are they ready to be released? And those are the questions I deal with. And I have, you know, in response, Elizabeth and Leona, to your question, there is so much family dysfunction. There is so much mental health and even issues that are as simple as learning disabilities that have been ignored in a person's youth to where it becomes a traumatic event in terms of their socialization. There is so much drug abuse in terms of people with mental illnesses who try to self-medicate, you know, to quiet those voices that are going around in their head, to quiet the emotional pain that they have. Of course, dysfunctional families, families with single mothers who are oftentimes working multiple jobs, just trying to keep, you know, the apartment rent paid, and they don't have proper time to supervise the children. So we see all of those factors. Unfortunately, society as a whole doesn't bother to look that deeply into the psyche of an individual, because the mentality is lock them up, get them out of sight. If they're out of sight, they're out of mind. That, of course, begs the question and ignores the reality that at some point, most of these people are going to come back to the community. And do you want a healthy individual coming back? Or do you want a tortured soul who's not going to stay out long before their behavior gets the best of them and they're returned in an endless kind of cycle?
Thank you. You know what I was going to say is Greg Abbott from your state, it wasn't too long ago that there was a prisoner who had been serving, he was in for 40 years. He was on death row. And he just got executed, I'd say, within the last few months. And I think that's an awful, inhumane, and barbaric way to end somebody's life that committed a serious crime. Because not only did they serve 40 years, which is almost like a life, but also to be put to death after 40 years of already serving. And we know that people, their lives change, you know, in time, their lives change. I don't know how old this man was when he went to prison. But we have, in this country, we have people that went to prison when they were teenagers. And now they're in their 60s and 70s and 80s. Many of them with Parkinson's disease, many of them with Alzheimer's or dementia, many of them terminally ill in wheelchairs, even in Massachusetts here. Another thing is I was going to bring up is the fact that a lot of these evaluations that are done by the prison psychologist, a lot of times they're diagnosing many, many prisoners with antisocial behavior, when in fact there are so many people incarcerated who are suffering from PTSD. And I wanted to find out if you ever worked with any prisoners or anyone incarcerated, men or women or youth, that has been misdiagnosed in those areas.
Oh, my gosh, yes. In Texas, again, to put it in perspective, mental health services in our prison system are to minimal. There are not qualified psychologists or therapists or counselors at any of the units. The psychological intake screening for an individual entering the prison system basically consists of a clerk, an untrained individual saying, "Are you suicidal?" That's the scope of the psychiatric evaluation. If someone comes into the prison with a history of some kind of mental illness and or psychiatric medications, they are unlikely to receive the same medications that they were getting in the free world. They are unlikely to go into any kind of regular counseling because those services just do not exist on a routine basis. They exist to tamp down emergencies and only for the purpose of controlling behavior rather than changing behavior. So misdiagnosis, yes, and TDC just doesn't give a damn because the attitude of our correctional institution, and that kind of starts with the politicians, you know, at the top, but the attitude is, who cares? They're just a bunch of prisoners. Our governor is a horrid right-wing Republican presidential wannabe. Greg Abbott is a very narrow-minded individual. His whole attitude as governor in terms of his attitude toward criminal justice has been, you know, kind of a MAGA reflection. More time, more restrictions, less understanding, build more prisons, incarcerate more people, keep people in prison longer. The politics of a country or even of a state jurisdiction influences how we treat the least fortunate. Not only the prisoners, but the homeless, the children who need nutrients, as youths. It's horrible. But the lowest rungs of the people in a society are the ones who are most abused, and that holds true with our criminal justice system in particular.
Thank you, Gary. Elizabeth, do you have any questions or feedback?
I thought it was interesting that you asked about those with PTSD. Texas is very much like a military city or a military area. Mm-hmm. And one of my extracurriculars is that I volunteer in a research lab that helps treat military members diagnosed with PTSD. And mm-hmm. I was just reflecting on what I've seen in their kind of like their intake procedures. And I've seen definitely like a lot of domestic violence, a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression. So it's interesting to know that many prisons, their intake procedure is just on suicide when there's such like a range of mental health conditions that can affect someone's daily functioning.
You're absolutely right, and I have represented over the course of my professional career a number of former military members and who have, through the ravages of war mm-hmm. or whatever, have severe PTSD. There are certain in our trial courts, in our county systems, there are certain diversion programs for veterans that are specifically related and focused on that. But again, if you look at our prison system, you know what they believe to be the source of most of the problems? They believe that drug and alcohol abuse is the source of most of the problems. Drug and alcohol abuse, as we know, is a symptom of other problems. It is.
Exactly.
It may be a precipitating factor, but there's, it's a drug and alcohol use is a mask. It's a healing tonic for people. It doesn't address the basic internal issues that result in the drug abuse. So in Texas, in our prisons, the most common rehabilitation program available is AA and NA. But again, programs for PTSD, for depression, for anxiety, for bipolar disorder, those are just not addressed at all unless an incarcerated individual's behavior becomes so extreme that it is disruptive to the administration of the institution. At that point, they ship them off to the state hospital, and they tranquilize them, and they walk around as zombies, and they're no longer a behavioral problem in terms of the administration of the prison. That is the short-sighted nature of what we have in Texas. And it's a mentality. If you can't take care of yourself, if you can't, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, then you're not much of an individual. And we just don't care about you as long as you're not bothering us.
I am so glad you're bringing these things up, because I'll tell you, again, addiction is an underlying, it's a cover-up. And I say this all the time. We have prisoners, we have people who have been, again, traumatized, are people that have had their lives shaken up and destroyed by others. You know, a lot of these people that have been molested as children, a lot of these people that have been raped as adolescents or children, but there's so many other things. But a lot of times, some are resilient, and they can pick themselves up and they can move forward and they can better themselves. But somewhere along the line, something can happen that can traumatize them all over again, and that resilience is no longer there. There are so many that turn to alcohol or drugs to hide their pain, and then there are some that will take to, say, exercises, weightlifting, taking care of their bodies, trying to be the best they can physically so that they know no one will ever be able to harm them again. And unfortunately, these things, once that resilience is gone, the weakness is there. They can't let their guard back up again. They've let their guard down, and now they can't undo what they've done. So they're either going to be depressed, seriously depressed, and it's going to turn into suicide or homicide. We never know when someone is severely depressed which way they're going to go. But then we look at the crime. So they if it's not suicide, it becomes a homicide. So now they're in a prison where they're supposed to be getting rehabilitation. But it's just the opposite, because so many people in prison are being abused all over again, traumatized all over again. And we have a system today that people are not willing to spend the time helping these prisoners to help them to get back to where they might have been in the first place if a tragedy didn't happen in the first place. We have people in prison who are suffering so much, and a lot of them are being denied the help, or they're being, as I mentioned earlier, misdiagnosed. I don't believe prisoners should be forced to double cell, because a lot of prisoners that have been traumatized cannot, they have that PTSD, they have that where they can't be double celled, they just can't handle it. So as soon as they're placed in a cell with someone else, they start automatically, they go off, they stop fighting, and then they're removed and put in solitary confinement or on a restrictive block. And the Department of Corrections, they know these things, and yet they force them to do these things. I don't understand why, but there's something that has to be done about it. And who do we turn to?
Well, you know, it all boils down to allocation of resources. What are their priorities when they pass budgets and when they, you know, give money to institutions? Prisons have never been a high priority, although the Texas Correctional Institution, the prison system in Texas, is one of our highest budgetary items. But ironically, corrections officers are severely underpaid. Our prisons are understaffed. There is a high rate of turnover. The number of, again, going back to rehabilitation services, is small. You would think that when you have, and I don't mean this as a pun, when you have a captive population that's going to be in a regimented, controlled environment, logically, when they enter that environment, you would do a deep assessment of their needs, and you would start focusing services on dealing with those conditions at the beginning of their incarceration, whether that's drug or alcohol issues, whether that's anxiety, whether it's, the whole panoply of whatever. You would start dealing with those issues to help them become a healthier human being at the beginning. But that's not what we do in Texas. For any kind of concentrated programming in our correctional institutional agencies, they, meaning the incarcerated individual, usually has to wait until they have been approved for release by the board before they get into any kind of focused programs such as sex offender treatment or long-term alcohol and chemical dependency classes. They put that as a Band-Aid on them just before they're letting them out back into the community, and then pushing the burden back into the community to provide those kind of services. And that's just warehousing human beings and watching them waste away. And, you know, while our recidivism rates in Texas have gone down, you know, over the past recent years, you know, there's a lot of serious individuals who need help and who want help, and we don't provide it. And as a result, just like Leona, as you were alluding to, you put an individual who's got problems in terms of socialization, you put them into a harsh environment, an abnormal, artificial environment, and it just exacerbates their problems, their psychoses, the tensions in their life. It doesn't give them the ability to better understand and handle stressors. So as you so accurately stated, they either become suicidal or they become homicidal. The rage has to go somewhere. The anger that builds up, the frustrations that build up, at some point explode. And it's so easy to see, yet it's so difficult to get the authorities to be able to address those issues in a long-term, rational manner.
It's sad that it happens. In Massachusetts, it was on the news this morning that Governor Haley is going to be releasing thousands of prisoners that have been serving sentences in prison for marijuana. And we know that marijuana, I believe, was recently, within the last year or two, has been approved as being legal. And so there's going to be thousands that are going to be released that are in for marijuana usage. But there was also a mention about a week or two ago that prisoners in Massachusetts are suing the Massachusetts Department of Corrections because an investigative team found that less than 2% are earmarked for educational opportunities and reentry programs. The department was budgeted with $800 million. And only 2% is allotted, or by the DOC, is allotted for educational opportunities and reentry. And we wonder why a lot of prisoners have said that they are being denied the opportunity to take any kind of educational or work programs. And I myself, we also look at the large corporations that are making all kinds of money on these prisoners that are working, because they're selling sneakers and other things for $300 and $400 a piece when the prisoners are getting less than a dollar a day. And then again, we have those that are not even afforded that opportunity to work or to have any kind of programs. When the time comes for parole or commutations, you know, clemencies or pardons, they have nothing to show for all the years they've been in, because they've been denied all these years to be able to participate in any programs. That's another thing I'd like to have your view on, and also you, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, please go ahead.
Yeah, super interesting. And even with the cases that I have helped you with, Leona, there's such a gap in treatment, and it's always scary to see how mental health is just not taken seriously at all.
Exactly.
It's also surprising. I think one of our cases also dealt with just like physical ailments and how even that is not even considered. And it just goes back to like the lack of humanization of prisoners, which is terrible because they are a vulnerable population. They are a captive population. And I also want to ask Mr. Cohen this, but in your time of teaching, have you noticed any like gaps in knowledge in the students that you've taught? I mean, you're very observant and you have a background in psychology, so I'm also curious about whether or not you've noticed that.
Well, I'm not sure when you say teaching. I'm not a lecturer at a university. I do participate in seminars for defense attorneys, you know, in the area of parole and prisons and pardons and clemency stuff like that. As you probably know very well, Elizabeth, and you as well, Leona, corrections law, parole law, prisons is not an area that's addressed in law school. You know, it's you know, you have contracts, you have wills, you have rules of procedure and evidence, and you have torts, and you have real estate, and, you know, stuff. But they don't teach, even in criminal courses. Lawyers come out of law school, they don't know the first thing about prisons. They know the sentencing ranges for an offense because that's in the penal code. But they don't understand anything about what happens to an individual when they go into prison. It's just not taught. So there aren't a lot of lawyers who pay attention to this. And, of course, that's what we're trying to do and educate is to develop an awareness amongst defense attorneys as to what happens post-conviction. Most people do not know, I mean, most defense lawyers don't know, well, how long does a person have to serve on a particular offense before they're eligible for parole? What are the parole approval rates? What does an individual have to do, toward demonstrating positive change during the period of incarceration in order for the voters to be impressed and render a favorable decision? Texas does have a fairly decent educational program. And when I say decent, please understand the context of relativity that I'm speaking about. Most everyone who comes into the institution, if they do not have a high school degree or GED, they will be required to take GED classes. There are opportunities for associate's degrees and bachelor's degrees master's degree programs in some of the units. There are a lot of technical and vocational training in computer work, coding, carpentry, long distance truck driving, welding, plumbing, those kind of trades. And those are sought after programs from an offender's standpoint. But there are not enough of them. There's not enough to service the population that's desirous of them. So a great deal of our offenders do just kind of sit idle. And of course, it's such a punitive environment that even the slightest infraction of an institutional rule or regulation on the part of the incarcerated individual, that'll kick them out of or bar them from entry into a lot of programs. And I'm talking about disciplinary cases that are so ridiculous, like having an extra T-shirt that's not assigned to you, improper storage of personal property, possession of contraband, which could be a piece of cheese that you got from the chow hall that you're not supposed to have. I mean, it is just built on ridiculous rules. And, of course, the corrections officers are the ones who enforce those laws. And, you know, if a corrections officer has a bad attitude towards an individual, my God, there's going to be a series of cases written up. And if it's the individual's word against the corrections officer's word, who do you think's going to win that fight?
Exactly.
You know? And that pushes them back. It reinforces the feeling that they're worthless. That regardless of what they do, they're pushed back. That the rug is, pulled out from under them at every opportunity. And that just continues to create an antisocial attitude in people who are not strong to begin with. The other thing that I have a serious problem with in Texas is that we have a wide range of years in our penal code for various offenses. 2 to 10, 2 to 20, 5 to 99, 25 to life. For different kinds of offenses, and we have, 250-something counties in Texas with lots of different judges. And as long as their punishment is within the ranges of punishment established by the law, that punishment is not likely to be reversed because of an abuse of discretion. So in one jurisdiction, you might have, an 18-year-old who gets convicted of an involuntary manslaughter, because they've had too much alcohol, and they may get, 8 years in prison for that. Somewhere else, maybe even in an adjoining county, they may get 20 years for that. There's such a wide variation depending on the sentencing authority that it really creates a topsy-turvy system. Additionally, in Texas, when an individual comes out of prison on community supervision, on parole, of course, they're still under the criminal justice system in terms of post-incarceration supervision, in terms of reporting to parole officers and so on, those people all have to serve the remainder of the unexpired portion of their sentence under supervision. In other words, there is no law that allows for the release of an individual who's done, let's say, 50% of their parole term and they haven't had any kind of infractions. There's no release for them. The only release is the parole officer can say, instead of you coming into my office weekly, you could come in monthly or you could come in quarterly. That's an insane system that just creates a lot of expense and a lot of unnecessary supervision of individuals. Any nonviolent offender who has been under supervision for 5 years with a good track record ought to be released from supervision. Why do we have to bother with them anymore? Violent offenders, maybe, because of the nature of their crimes or criminal histories, they maybe should be supervised in the community for a longer period of time. But at some point, even people convicted of murder or sexual offenses against children, if they have a spotless record and if they have 100% compliance with programming, with reporting, with all of the other rules of supervision, if they've got a 10 or 12 or 15 year history, they're not going to do anything wrong. Why do we still stigmatize them? Why do we still spend money on supervising folks that have proven after incarceration and after a long period of supervision that they are changed individuals? Why do we keep after denigrating them by making them serve out another 20 or 30 or 40 years on paper.
And it's costing us as taxpayers, because I know in the work that I've done, I know of prisoners that were released and had to follow, as you said, the weekly probation. And they've lost their jobs. They were able to obtain jobs, which they lost because they had to take that time off to go and meet with their probation officers.
Right.
That is, it's not only preventing them from having a normal life, but it's also a cost to the taxpayers to be paying all this money only to have these people fail. And that's why the recidivism rate goes back up again.
No, I totally agree with you.
You also mentioned, Gary, that a lot of the lawyers, they didn't know, there was a lot of things that they didn't know in those, in various areas of incarcerated people. And I wanted to real quickly state, as a social worker myself, I have seen people that have gone to school for social work, they never taught about cultures. I come from a multicultural family background, so I've had the opportunity to be in all kinds of situations in all areas. But people that are young people that are going to be social workers, going to school, they're not taught about the cultures. And a lot of the homes that we go into, the families that we interact with, they're of all different cultures. And they all have different ways of disciplining and different ways of living. And these social workers coming out of school, a lot of them are from predominantly white and wealthy areas. A lot of them don't have children. Most of them don't have children. They don't have any, they're not married. And they're going into homes where there's families that they're going to have to talk to these families and tell these families what they need to do in order to keep their children at home. And when people, when single parents or when other people, in husband and wives, when they're threatened at the loss of the possible loss of their children because social workers that have no experience are going to tell them what they have to do, then that means that the social workers are going to have problems with the families they're trying to work with and they're trying to help. That's one thing. I think the schools, people should, even in law schools, I think they should be taught about different cultures. I think they need to be taught, like you say, psychology. Elizabeth is going to school or has graduated, is graduating from school for psychology and also criminal justice. And you as well, Gary. I think more of this needs to be brought into the schools.
That's more such a good point.
It does. It has to be.
That's such a good point. So over December, I had applied to doctoral programs, and I got two interviews. And so in one of them, there were maybe 60 other people that had applied and got into that interview. I was probably one of three Latinas, and that was such a cultural shock. I mean, I know that there's a gap in, you know, women of color in STEM and in those fields, but I was still so surprised. And I was even more surprised when I noticed that their diversity panel was not diverse. And so the program that I will be going to, they focus a lot on cultural humility, and I think that that's super important because there are differences in how we can treat people of color, and not many people work to address that.
I totally agree with both of y'all that is a, you know, a deep societal deficiency in terms of us not bringing up our children and not having our educational systems understand, you know, the diversity that exists in this country. And, you know, how are we going to, I grew up a middle-class Jewish kid in the South. You know, predominantly my elementary and high schools were white. There were not many Hispanics, people of color, people from different cultural or, you know, different nations for me to interact with. And so you grow up with blinders on, and you become, you don't have the tolerance because you don't have the understanding of what other people are going through. My career as a defense attorney, of course, has exposed me to a plethora of folks from, you know, different cultures, different nations, different, you know, different belief systems. You know, I've represented outlaw motorcycle gangs. I've represented, you know, white nationalists. I've represented, gang leaders. In the black community, in the brown community. These are not people that I know anything about. But you know, over the years, I hope that I have kept my mind open and tried to gain an understanding. And you know, even though you don't understand a cultural norm, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. They could be entirely valid within that cultural community, but the people who are in power, who have a limited perspective, are judgmental because, and society has gotten even more so recently. It's my way because I'm in control. You're wrong. I'm right. And I'm not even going to listen to why you don't think I'm right. That's become the dominant attitude in politics, in society, and in culture. And it is destructive.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to I believe Elizabeth mentioned the medical issues in the prisons. And real quickly, I just want to go into that because one of the things I see too is like WellPath. WellPath is a contracted medical provider with the Department of Corrections, not only in Massachusetts, but across the country in various states. And WellPath, there's been a lot of lawsuits filed against WellPath and also a doctor, Dr. Adriana Carrillo, these medical lawsuits. And I'm wondering why, and some of these jails are starting, they're reconsidering whether or not they want to contract with these medical providers. But these are issues that we have in this country too. A lot of people have been permanently damaged by these medical providers that the Department of Corrections brings in. And I believe that they bring in the cheapest of labor. And I find that some of these medical providers that have performed surgery on prisoners were not really qualified to do the surgery. So Adriana Carrillo, from what I understand, there's been hundreds of suits filed against her, but there's been over 1,000 lawsuits filed against WellPath medical providers. I don't know if you've ever represented any prisoners who have been damaged, malpractice lawsuits or whatever, in the prisons throughout the country or in Texas area. That was one question I wanted to ask. And then I wanted to go back also to the sentencing guidelines, but medical right now is something I'm very interested in.
Well, I haven't, and there are a number of reasons. Number one, I don't engage in that kind of litigation. My practice is limited to administrative matters before the parole board. So I don't do those kind of lawsuits. Secondly, one of the problems with those kind of lawsuits is that states and state agencies and state officials, by and large, have a broad privilege that protects them from liability claims. It's incredibly complex and incredibly expensive litigation. And most offenders don't have the resources. Most lawyers don't want to take on the cases because of the obligation and the immensity of the job. And even if they could get a case where they could get it to a trial before a jury, juries are not really sympathetic to offenders. In Texas, there is a managed correctional care system, where the Texas prison system contracts with, for instance, the University of Texas Medical Center for care in the southern regions, for Texas Tech a Medical Center in the northern regions, but the agencies, the medical agencies who provide service, yes, you're absolutely right, they do it on the cheap, but even on the cheap, there it's a losing proposition for them in terms of profit. And you find horrible quality of care. You find doctors that are under contract through the correctional managed care system who have lost their licenses in damn near all the states, or who are practicing in an area for which they're not qualified. You find that the care that the offenders need is oftentimes viewed with skepticism and suspicion on the part of the correctional institution. In other words, these people are just malingering. You know, they want the pill because they want to get high or they don't want to work anymore. So needs that you and I have to where we can go to the urgent care clinic and we can be proactive in terms of our care, that paradigm does not exist within the prisons. So the prisoners who get medical attention, because understand, you don't have doctors on all these units. You don't have nurses on all these units. You have clinical workers without degrees. So an offender has to be really sick, really in a distressed situation for them to be taken to the hospital. And then, of course, the conditions in the hospital wards in these facilities, that's not a piece of cake. I mean, I've visited inmates in medical wards at John C. Lee at Galveston. I've gone into hospital rooms and found the most disgusting conditions in terms of sanitation and hygiene, and inmates who are handcuffed to the beds. And, you know, they can ring a call button for hours before anybody may come in to even look at them. It's awful. It used to be, strangely enough, and I've been around long enough to be able to remember the, quote, old days. It used to be that dental care in the Texas prisons was great. I mean, if people needed, false teeth, if they needed corrective dental surgery, they would ship them to the UT Medical Facility in Galveston. And because the institution, felt that that was a source of pride and self-worth in the individual. And it was. But that stopped. But if you also look back historically, too, it used to be that individuals had access to Pell Grants for higher incarcerated individuals, had access to Pell Grants for higher education. That's been eliminated, too.
Exactly.
You know, so it's, you know, we're not taking any big steps forward in how we care for this population. And you know, there's such a disadvantage, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, you have people of low income that populate our prisons. You have people of color that form the majority of that populate our prisons. These are people who didn't have the necessary resource for proper legal defense when they were arrested. They continue, once they're incarcerated, to be ignored. And so what do you have when you let a person like that back into the world. You have somebody with a prison record, a stigma as a felon, that prevents them from getting housing, that prevents them from getting employment. The employment they get is going to be menial jobs at minimum wage. They may have a wife or a family. There's no way. There's no way that they can have a normal life. They are doomed and destined to failure by the way society continues to treat them. I mean, it's you know, there's just no way that you can look at our system from any aspect that you examine our correctional institutions. There is no bright shining light on the horizon.
No. I trained actually in 2005 or 6. I trained with the Department of Corrections. I with the different it was in mental health management at Bridgewater State Hospital, but it was with the different correctional services. It was with MHM, which was out of Virginia, and they were excellent. These people were excellent. However, there was a female guard that told me that I wasn't to speak with the prisoners, which was my purpose, my whole role in the training. So I went to my supervisor and I asked her about it. And she said, no, Leona, she said, I speak with the prisoners too. She said, that's what they need. Just like Franz talked about, you know, how he would speak with prisoners and he would treat them humanely and respectfully, and they reciprocated. That's what we have to do. I don't think it has much to do with training. I think it has to do with the heart, the circumcision of our heart. So everybody's different in the way they think, in the way they operate. And I'm going to bring Franz on with us in a few minutes. He's been patiently waiting, and also another caller. So I'm going to be bringing them in. I just wanted your feedback on that, really.
Well, real quickly, just from an experience that goes back almost 40 years in dealing with prisons, when I would go to the prisons, you know, as a young lawyer, it was not uncommon for the guards to refer to human beings as fangs. Now, that's a Southern slur term for things. They dehumanized people that they would call them fangs. Come here, you old fang. Go get the broom, you fang. Or they would call them boys, a horrible racist, you know, stereotype going back. And it's a very common one. But that's the indifference. I still go into prison some days, and I'll go in and I'll see my client, and I'll shake their hand, and I've had people in the prison say to me, "Oh, how can you touch those people?" That mentality still exists in the minds of so many. These are filthy people. They're vermin. They're subhuman.
Can I interrupt on that just real quickly? This is one of the reasons why I don't believe prisoners should be forced to double cell, because there's a lot of people inside of prison that have been in for years and years and years, and they still take care of their hygiene very, very carefully. They're very clean. And to be put in a cell with somebody with the hygiene, and I'm sorry, not all prisoners are like this, but there are people who are being forced to double cell with people that are totally, it's terrible. And I just wanted to bring that up because that's an issue that needs to be addressed.
You're right. So let's hear from Franz. I haven't heard his voice in a while.
Franz Dow, I am sorry to keep you on for a few minutes, but it's welcoming Franz Dow, from a former warden from Amsterdam, who has been doing a lot of good work all over the country and the world. Franz, can you hear us okay?
Yes, thank you, Leona. And I'm a little bit surprised because I hear Gary is already in the show.
He's been in from the beginning. I meant to tell you, and I just realized why you're coming on late. We had a time change. The clocks were turned ahead an hour. And even I didn't know it. I woke up one morning and some of my clocks were saying 7 o'clock and some were saying 8. Until later on in the news, I heard that the time had changed. 406, I'm going to call upon you in a few minutes, if you can just hold 1 second until Franz can be introduced. Again, Franz, everybody knows you. Everybody loves you. So if you just give
thank
the audience.
You. I wouldn't say that too loud. Everybody loves you. But
everybody.
There are a few, at least.
Very good. So,
well, nice being here. So you started at my time, 7 o'clock. Gary is already 1 hour explaining.
Yeah, we have a half an hour. We have a little over a half an hour left, so feel free to
come. Okay. Well, let's react on questions or so, because then I can probably add something to what Larry already said.
Gary mentioned something about the sentencing guidelines, and Gary, I wanted to bring that up as well. Gary was talking about, and can you say again, Gary, can you talk about the guidelines? Because one of the things I wanted to bring up, and Franz, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but most countries have a sentencing guideline of 25 years maximum, unless it involves terrorism or mass killings or serial killings or whatever. Is that correct to say, Franz?
You're talking about
sentencing,
I don't know that word, the sentencing guidelines. I only know that in Europe, the irreversible life sentence is not according to the rules and the laws of the European court. So a punishment has to end somehow, or at least there has to be a chance that somebody gets out before he dies.
Okay, that's it. I was saying earlier today before you came on, our governor here, Maura Healey, mentioned she's releasing thousands of prisoners in Massachusetts who have been serving time, long sentences in prison for marijuana, because marijuana became legal about a year, 2 years ago, and yet they've been sitting in prison. So she is right now, she's looking at releasing about 1,000 prisoners, releasing them from prison who are serving time for marijuana usage.
Yeah, that's a great step to do that. Because it's locking up people for that reason is damaging for not only the people, but also for the families and also for society as a whole. So she stopped a very bad practice, I think.
Yeah. And they're also making it possible they're taking a percentage, I think it's 18 or 20 incarcerated individuals to apply for clemency. And again, this is where I have a problem, because there's a lot of them that deserve to be able to go up for clemency, but because they've been denied programs throughout the years, it's preventing them from showing that they have done anything productive to be able to apply for clemency, even though they're over the age of 55. And this is medically, some of them are medically damaged because of the medical inappropriate medical provisions. So these are some issues that I have a problem with too. I'm going to put myself on mute so that you can speak. And 406, if you want to jump in at some point in time, right now, Franz, we'll see what happens with this.
Okay.
Hello. This is 406. I have a question for the gentleman speaking on prisons. How much money do the states make for the prison and the prisoners? One of the things that I've realized is that when a person goes into solitary confinement, they become institutionalized, they become insane, and they basically become dysfunctional. And so I was wondering how prisons in other countries are operated, how much money they make. And once something becomes a business in America, it is very hard to stop it from being, rewritten or adjusted for the population. And I also think that if you killed more than 5 people, you should be killed instantly, death penalty. And if a rapist raped more than, a certain amount of women, they should be castrated instantly. They've proven that they cannot be in society. They've proven that society doesn't work for them. And so those are just the questions I have. Thank you very much. I'll stop there.
Well, shall I give it a try? let's first talk about the money prisons are making. When you, I'm sure I don't know the exact dollar and euro amounts, but I'm sure that the damage of locking up people is incredibly, also economically, because like in the United States, when you have more than 2 million people locked up, you miss a lot of money and a lot of talent and a lot of love from those people working outside and giving their energy and their contribution to society. So it's that's an enormous waste. The second enormous waste is that when somebody gets in prison, it touches also their children, their parents, their family, their neighborhood. So the damage from a prison sentence for society and for, in average, the 50 people who are directly have the consequences of an incarceration of one person is enormous. What I notice when I am in the United States and see people work in Texas, for example, working the soil, shackled and with guards on horses around them, work the whole week and don't get any money. It's, you know, really a continuation of the slavery. And I think one, they earn some money with it, but it must be a lot less than the damage society has also economically by putting all those people away. Another thing is that really it became a big industry in your country. That's not a fact in Western Europe. Usually we have some private prisons, but not so much as in the United States. And what you see is that it isn't the kind of industry that you have in the United States. But when you have this economic interest locking up people, it makes the urge to lock up people very big as well. Does that answer your question a bit? I'm sorry?
Yes, sir. You answered all my questions. Thank you.
Okay, there's a second one, and it's a very interesting question too. That is that you say that certain people need to be killed by the government, in your opinion, because they are not able to function in society anymore. Is that true?
Yes, sir. That's true. Like serial killers, serial rapists, people like that, people that cannot control themselves.
I can say a few things about my moral point of view on this, on what you say, and something about my own experience. Well, in my opinion, and that's not only my opinion, but it's also the opinion of the Council of Europe, people shouldn't, governments shouldn't kill people. The death penalty is seen as a violation of human rights and as a form of torture in Europe. So that's why in Europe we don't have the death penalty anymore. There is a very, very small group of people who stay dangerous, you know. It's a very, very, very small group. In my experience, there are a few more important things when people do things that you describe. In the first place, when you create the circumstances in which you treat people in a human environment who are doing these kinds of crimes, then in the Netherlands, for example, the recidivism rate is very low. You know, so in general, the treatment of those kind of people is pretty successful. The only people that I have seen that stay dangerous, that are people who are with very, very severe disorders, who are not treatable at all. And then we believe, and I believe, that you should treat them in a humane way. Yeah. So put them in an environment in which they can't harm other people, but experience a good quality of life. Probably be valuable and add value to their environment within the walls. Our experiences, for example, with people who do sex crimes, and sometimes, you know, the sex drive is so strong, and that's not only, you know, you can't solve that only with castration, because it's also something that happens in the brains, you know. You have to keep them in a protected and safe environment. And our experience is that you can keep in an other kind of safe environment than a prison. We call that long stay facilities. Those are meant for people we think in the Netherlands that they can't get out anymore. And what we experience is that they know those people very well. We don't need, for a lot of them, high walls, but we use other ways to keep them under control and avoid that they, for example, go look for children or women or, you know, whatever they target for. So for me, the most important thing is, apart from what those people deserve or what they can contribute to society as a whole, is that I think it's very important that we don't become killers ourselves, you know. Don't do the things that we believe other people and people in society are also not allowed to do. For me, that's very important, because as soon as you entitle yourself, if you give the power to a judge or a politician or anybody to kill people, I think you do a step back in your civilization, I think. That's what I believe in. And, well, there are a few people over here who also ask for the death penalty. And I can understand that, because when you see the horror and the severity of the crimes people sometimes commit, people get scared and they get they say, well, let's kill them, lock them up forever, or kill them. Or I understand fear, but one of the things that I also notice in the Netherlands, but also when I was in Texas a few weeks ago, is that about everything that determines people's behavior comes from fear, almost. And I think that's not a very good development, you know, to act because you're afraid of things going wrong, of people. I was walking in Houston and talking to a lot of people, and it seems that everybody is scared for everybody and nobody trusts anybody, you know? That's one of the things I noticed in your country. Do you recognize that image?
I don't.
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay.
Yes, sir, I do.
I was just going to say, 406, I just wanted to say real quick, when we talk about or think about what you're saying mm-hmm. about these people that do these kind of atrocious things, it brings me back to psychological. It brings me back to mental health issues, because anybody that is that sick to do those kind of things has got to have some kind of mental illness. And a lot of people that commit these kind of crimes too, they grew up in that kind of violence, you know, that kind of And it not only destroys them, but sometimes it destroys other people's children as well. And this is sad because it's something that goes all the way back to their upbringing.
Yeah, that's certainly an aspect. But I understand very much that the caller, I forgot your name, but the caller says those people are very, very dangerous. We need to execute them. I understand where it comes from. And I'm interested in what he says about reacting from fear, and about the moral standards that are used in the European Union. What do you think of that?
My name is John Three Fingers. I'm on the Northern China Reservation. one of the questions I have is, I believe that when a person becomes institutionalized in prison, it didn't start there. It started on their street. It started in their society, because a lot of these people that are in prison, they expected to go to prison for their lifestyle and their life in general. They really have no control about what happens to them. So they are pretty much following what society has led them to believe is their path. And a lot of times when they do that in prison, they are taken advantage of by society and by their employers. A lot of them will only get paid half of their paycheck, and they have no recourse. They have nobody to go to address that situation. And society in America always comes down to dollars.
I very much agree with you on that. Yeah, very much agree on that. That's very true. Otherwise, what do you think about the idea that when you start killing people as a government, people you don't have to kill because you also can put them in a secure environment, for example, or take other measures. What do you think about why not keeping them alive? Why not? Is that because of dollars, or why killing them?
Basically, compassion and hope is dead in America. We don't care about them, because once they reach that certain level, we become afraid of them. And once a prisoner comes back to the society, he will always be looked upon as dangerous. He will always be looked upon as a wild animal. It shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is. And once a person becomes that creature, he has no choice but to feel like he doesn't belong in society anymore. He isolates himself. He stays out of public areas. You know, he does the things that he needs to do to survive. And on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, we don't live, we survive. And so everything is pretty much black and white here. We don't have gray area.
I understand that. And I was in Texas a few weeks ago, like I said, and I met a few friends of mine. One of them is 31 years in prison now. He's doing a life sentence, and the other is 47 years on death row now. And they are good friends of mine. And especially the guy who is on death row, he killed somebody when he was 18 years old. And he is one of the sweetest and most restored and nonviolent people that I know. And one of the most important issues that he had to deal with is that everybody sees him as a monster from a young age. He's bad, he's wrong, there are all kinds of security measures around him. He is in his cell for 23 hours a day. And the most important danger is that you yourself start believing that you are the monster that others think you are, you know? You internalize that you are a monster, that it's wrong with you, that you're not okay, that you are useless, that you can't contribute anything, etc., etc. And those two guys, those two friends of mine, dealt with that, and they, because of their friends, their network, their activities inside, they are both writers. The guy who is 31 years inside, he did two university degrees during his sentence, and he wrote books, etc., etc. Those guys could successfully resist looking at themselves the way they are looked at, and become every day the best of themselves, you know? Do you recognize that? Are there people around you who did the same thing? Or maybe you did the same thing? How do you survive?
Exactly. Because basically it comes down to human nature versus societal norms, benefit versus disadvantage. We are given the path that we are given at birth. If you're born poor, you have to fight for everything that you have. If you're born well off, you don't have the options of being, you know, having to struggle, having to learn the basic rule of, you know, being a good person. Society decides for you right at birth where you're going to be. And if you're a different skin color, then that puts, you know, the onus on you to become stronger. You have to fight society to be at an advantage. You have to fight society to be worthwhile in everybody else's eyes. At this time in our society, I have never been in such control of another person's comfort. When I'm walking down the street, that person is uncomfortable with me because I am brown. And that person walks across the street, a lot of minorities feel that. And so in 2030, 2045, there would be more minorities than Caucasians in the U.S. And they see that. They feel that. They see it in their television. They see it in their commercials. And so they tighten their grip. They isolate themselves, and they make changes where we, the majority of minorities, do not have access to what they did when they were the majority. And so we have to fight for everything that we have. Thank you.
Do you live on a reservation, John, or do you live in the regular community?
I live on a reservation. We have 83% unemployment. We do not live. We survive. We worry about food. We worry about food. We worry about clothing. We worry about shoes. We worry about things that should be basic to everybody. We don't have a food bank. We don't have a soup kitchen. And so all our families get together. Somebody brings beans. Somebody brings bread. Somebody brings whatever they can. And so we all get together and we have communal meals. That is how we survive, and that's how we always survived on the reservation. If anything goes down, we don't have far to go. If society went down, we will still continue to live in this manner. So society has pretty much passed us by, but in a lot of ways, we live in paradise here.
John, can you say something about the middle class in the United States, the white people, the white middle class in the United States, higher middle class, people who live in the suburbs and who have a house and car, etc., etc. Are they different people than people in the reservation? Do you believe that?
Yes. Yes, I do. We don't have the options of learning what we need to learn to get, you know, ahead in life.
Yeah, that's true. Are they as a person, as individuals, as human beings, different than people in the suburbs? Do they
no.
have different
we all want
dreams, different needs, or whatever? Yeah.
As humans, we all want the same thing. We all want comfort. We all want to be having no stress in our lives. We all want to be able to contribute to our families, to society, and to the greater good. But when you have to fight through certain things, it makes that dream a little further away. The way I equate it is you're looking at a city that is surrounded by deep, dark woods, and you see that city way over there, and it's shining like a jewel in the night. But you will be in the dark until you figure out a way to get to that shining city. And that shining city is comfort and security.
Isn't that totally crazy? Because I have children, I have grandchildren, and I'm 100% sure that they have the same talents, the same dreams, that they play the same games as the children and the little kids in your community, you know? They're exactly the same. When my grandchildren of 3 and 5 years old would play with the children in your neighborhood, they would have a great time together, you know? So it's very crazy that we as human beings, while we should be allies, because we're all in the same situation and we're all the same, have so much fear for each other that, for example, in the United States, we lock up more than 2 million people. And I think there are about almost 4 million people who are somehow on parole or under supervision or et cetera, et cetera. People don't trust each other. When I walk in your cities, I see fences everywhere. I see people in uniform everywhere. You know? It's so crazy. People who are just people and who are all the same are seeing each other as enemies and don't trust each other. And I'm sure that one of the factors that creates so much inequality and poverty, etc., etc., that is that everybody lives in his own bubble and doesn't care about the people in the other bubbles, you know? And even black people who live in one neighborhood seem to behave like each other enemies a lot, you know? Very crazy.
Franz, I wanted to say, and I wanted to ask if you and Gary and John, actually, John, and Elizabeth, if you would be willing to come back on in 2 weeks, because this there's so much to this topic, but I also wanted to say, I interviewed Nina Champion, who is a consultant and also has a degree in criminal justice from London, and I interviewed her, and I interviewed Kimberly Mactarian, who is the founder, she's also a consultant, founder of Save Our Sons in the United States. And one of the things we talked about is the possibility of having an international, trying to get our government to at least meet once a year to go over a lot of these issues and see where the successes are, like in your countries and how they can use them in this country. But what they want to do is Kimberly and Nina, and I've been referring people to them as well, that want to be involved, they're going to have like a virtual meeting, a Zoom meeting, for anyone that wants to do this to come together to start looking at doing something on a national, international level once a year, to go over all of these things and see how we can form some kind of consistency across the globe in the way things are operated. In the United States, we have prisons are run by the governors in each state for state prisoners. And the problem is the same in all the states, but the operations are different. There's no consistency, as you or Gary was saying earlier. So these are some issues that we could probably do something about if we started doing something on an international level and bringing up the positives of the work that you and others do in your countries to make things work. And hopefully we can share information to try to get things more consistent across the globe. I don't know if you have the time, but I would love to have the two of you back on next Wednesday and whatever time that you're available, and we can continue this conversation with others calling in as well.
Well, next Wednesday, I'm in Brussels with a conference.
The Wednesday after? The Wednesday after?
The one after that, how long will we talk with each other? Because I must say that that evening, a prison teacher, which is a friend of mine, is visiting me that night, and we're going to. So we could we could join for a while, probably not the whole evening.
We could do it in April. We could do it on an either a Wednesday or a Thursday in March or April.
Yeah, that would be great. For example, let's see. That's nice to say as well. The 3rd of April, I will do a lecture for criminality students in Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Angie Dent, she organized.
Oh,
that.
Okay. Yes, that's
so
good. That's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's very nice. So it's okay, but we have to find a date. Is it important that it is on a Wednesday?
No, it could be any day at all. I usually interview on Monday at 5:30, and I interview on Tuesdays at 5:30. It could be Wednesday or Thursday, or even Friday if you want. I could schedule something then. If you and Gary would like to talk about it and get back to me on the dates and times,
that's good. What do you say, Gary?
Oh, I would be honored and delighted. I think it's a fascinating discussion, and yes, I would certainly look forward to doing it. I have a bit more open schedule, Franz, than maybe you do.
Shall we do it April 2?
April
and then
2nd.
The 2nd of April? April 2, Tuesday?
Okay, that would be good. And what time?
Well, for me, 8 o'clock, which I started now as well, would be great because otherwise I end up in the middle of the night.
Okay, so that would be... You said that at 8 o'clock your time?
Yeah, my time. Yeah, Amsterdam time.
Okay, so that would be 2 o'clock our time. That would be the same.
Yeah, that's the same as we did today.
Yeah.
Okay.
And probably for Gary it's different then.
It works for me because that would be noon my time in New Mexico. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's do that.
That would be great. And also, I was going to say, Veronique, she's in the Netherlands. Veronique she's the founder of Rescaled. Are you familiar? You know her, right?
I'm a member of Rescaled.
And, okay, so that's
the
February.
In February, we will be in Brussels for 2 days, together with experienced experts from prisons in Europe. And professionals, and we will talking about these subjects in Brussels for 2 days. And my organization is also a member of Rescaled. And
I would love to have you speak a little bit about that too, because that's a detention house. And she was talking about regular houses for the prisoners, and then the bigger houses for the
moms. I should, if I were you, I would invite Veronique as well.
Okay, I will do that. And I will say, these programs that you have over there are really awesome. And if we can do this international convention, it can be done virtually. But if we can do this international convention and have all of these speaking issues.
There's another person you need to invite. That is Khalil Gaid.
I've interviewed him as well.
Yeah, and he is in the process of organizing a world conference for people who have been incarcerated. So it would be very nice. He's a very neat guy. It would be very nice to invite him as well. You have his information, haven't you?
I have him on WhatsApp. I'll get in contact with him unless you want to talk with him as well and let him know.
I will see him before, but it's better that that you do the invitations. I will tell them, of course, because I will meet them several times before that. But it's better that you invite them to
This will be great. We need to do something on an international level. This is going to be – and, John, if you want to invite Chinupa or anybody else you want from the Native tribe to join us as well.
I will do that.
And Elizabeth, if you can co-host with me again, I'd appreciate it. You are awesome. Elizabeth Franz, I was telling Gary and also John, Elizabeth has been a volunteer with New Vision Organization in Massachusetts, and she's in Texas, and she's psychology and also major. She's graduating psychology and criminal justice, and she's going to be moving to California, but she can too also be a very, very
Nice. And I would like to say something to John. I'm really touched, John, by what you described about the situation your people are in this reservation. It's such a harsh, such difficult life, and it's so unjust that you are in that situation. That I wish you all the strength you need, and I think. It is an incredible challenge to live in the reservation like you do, and I have a lot of respect for the fact that you do, and that you came to this show and, you know, opened yourself and was part of the discussion. Thank you very much.
And I too, John, want to thank you. Hearing your voice and your thoughts are very instructive, and I very much appreciate your point of view and look forward to hearing more about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyone
thank
would
you,
like
sir,
to listen to before we close?
Thank you, sir. Let me just say something real quick. Thank you, sir. I appreciate Leona and having me on. Leona, what you're asking for is a gentle insurrection. You will be going to against society, societal norms, and everything like that. But a gentle insurrection is where we need to be, because shaking things up is the only way we would change society. Thank you.
There's a lot of people that are suffering in this world today, and we really need to try to do something on a consistent basis. And I'm just honored to have all of you on with me today. And I'm hoping that the next time we meet, we'll all be able to come up with a lot of solutions. But this, if we can do something on an international level, I think that's the beginning.
And Leona, will you be sending out new blog invites
yes.
to us for April the 2nd?
Yes.
Lovely. I look forward to it. And I hope you all have a very wonderful day.
Before we
thank
go,
you too, Gary.
Would everybody like to give the audience your contact information or any information you want that to get out before we end this episode?
I'd be happy to. My address in Texas is 600 West 9th Street, Austin, Texas, 78701. And my office phone is 512-476-6201. And my email address is my first and last name. That is Gary, G-A-R-Y, Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, at Parole Law. That's parolelaw.com.
Thank you so much, Franz.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, everybody can find Franz on the internet. Just type in Franz Del.
Yeah. Shall I put my email address? That's probably
yes.
the quickest way. Franz, F-R-A-N-S, Dow, D-O-U-W, then the number 1, at gmail.com.
Okay. And Elizabeth?
Yes. Sure. My email is Eliza, E-L-I-Z-A, 222, Santos, at gmail.com.
Okay. And John?
My email is medbird, M-E-D-B-I-R-D, number one, at hotmail.com. My phone number is 406-477-6144. Thank you.
And are you on Facebook, John?
Yes, sir. I'm on Facebook under John Three Fingers. I'm an artist by trade, but I'm fighting the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and I'm fighting our tribe. So much money has been stolen, I've started a landowner organization. I believe with knowledge, you can tie a forked tongue together and make it speak the truth. So that's where I'm at.
Well spoken. Well spoken, John. And I think I already found you. Yeah, John Three Fingers. I found you. I will send you I will connect with you on Facebook.
Excellent, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And Francis, good luck with the lecture you have with the law students in Ohio. Angie is awesome, and I'm glad that she connected you with them.
Yeah, we said people, and I really look forward to meet them for a few hours, a group of students over there. Yeah, it's very nice.
Thank you so much. And Gary, thank you for coming on. I'm glad that Franz introduced you to us, and I feel honored to have all of you on today. So we're going to be closing, and I look forward to April 2nd to
We will see you then.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Audience, we are now going to end this episode. I thank you all for listening in, and please join us April 2nd, which is on a Wednesday, I believe, at 2 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, to hear our guest again. Thank you all so much for being on with us, and we are now going to close. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.